This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Hello and welcome to the Glorious Days Australia in 1913 lecture series. My name is Guy Hansen. I'm a senior curator here at the National Museum of Australia, and I'd like to welcome you here. It's wonderful to see such a fantastic crowd for this event today. I'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, past and present, on whose land we meet today. The 1913 lecture series has been devised by our public programs team to augment and support the Glorious Days Australia 1913 exhibition, which is currently on display in the main hall, in the gallery just off the main hall. This exhibition will be on display until later this year, until the 13th of October. This lecture series is being recorded, and your attendance here is considered consent to be recorded. So now's your chance to express your lack of consent if you're not happy with that. Also, I'd like to ask you to turn off your mobile phones if you have them here, or put them on discreet or silent. The Glorious Days Australia 1913 exhibition is our contribution to the celebration of Canberra's centenary. But the exhibition looks beyond the events of the 12th of March 1913 in Canberra to explore the context for Canberra's naming ceremony. It looks at what it was like to live in Australia in 1913, to the events, the beliefs, the fears of the time, and how they reveal what remarkable optimism for the future there was in Australia at that time. And of course, it's an interesting precursor to what we all know was coming, World War I. Our speaker today is Andrew Sayers, the director of the National Museum of Australia. Andrew was the lead curator of the 1913 exhibition and the originator of the idea for this show as well. Many of you will know that Andrew was previously director at the National Portrait Gallery and also had a long and distinguished career at the National Gallery. Andrew's research interests are very diverse and wide. He's published in the areas of Sydney Nolan, Aboriginal arts in the 19th century, and many other things as well. But today he's going to be talking to us about art and the artist in Australia in 1913. Andrew.
Thanks. Thanks very much, Guy. Now, there's a book about the year 1913. It's called, or subtitled, 1913, A Beginning... Oh, that book too. this book was published in English. It's called 1913, A Beginning and a Swan Song. So, given that this is my last public lecture as director of the National Museum, it's a swan song. I want to begin by just looking at what was the character of Edwardian art, and look at three pictures painted by Australian artists living in London. This is George Lambert's Chesham Street, 1910. It's a painting that's in the National Gallery collection and is a self-portrait. Next, please. This is Arthur Streeton's lithograph, Corfe Castle, of 1912. And this is Septimus Power's A Hunt in the Midlands, painted in 1912 and exhibited in Melbourne in 1913. Now, I think the characteristic which unites these three pictures is that they all have a very weighty sense of their own place within tradition, and they all are located very solidly within the British art world. So George Lambert, who painted that picture, Chesham Street, had left Australia as a brilliant student in 1900, and returned to Australia in 1921. Arthur Streeton had gone to London a few years earlier than that and returned to Australia in 1920. And Septimus Power left Australia in 1905 and came back to Australia in 1913, the year of our exhibition, and had a lot of pictures such as this under his belt to show in Melbourne. And in a sense, these were artists who everybody sort of thought had made it because they had shown at the Royal Academy and they were really a part of British art. Next, please. And I think one of the tendencies within Australian art history is to think of the Edwardian period as a period in which the experience of the expatriate artists living in London and France really was the central focus of Australian art. But I want to spend a bit of time today beginning by looking at what the domestic art scene really was like. This is a page from the Sydney Mail in 1913, and it shows a selection of pictures from the Royal Art Society exhibition. There are two pictures there by Antony Datolo Rubo, The Ruling Passion, which is a picture which still exists in the Manly Art Gallery. It's about problem gambling. Then there are two pictures by Septimus Power, The Two Horses, Young England, one of them's called, and the other one's called The Uplands. And then in the bottom corner is Lister Lister's painting called Canberra. More about that a bit later. Now, the strike's aftermath, which is in the middle of the screen, next slide, please, is actually in the 1913 exhibition and is a very typical successful picture from 1913. And this picture went immediately into the Art Gallery of New South Wales collection in that year. To us, it looks a bit sort of, it's all those caramel and toffee and chocolate colours that really are distinctive of, Victorian painting and which survived into the Edwardian period. Subject matter is contemporary, labour relations, and that's where we've got it in the exhibition. Next, please. One of the great pictures of the year 1913 was Hans Hyson's Red Gold. And like the strike's aftermath, it immediately entered the state collection through a gift to the Art Gallery of South Australia in 1913. So it was recognised as a major statement in that year. Next, please. And another picture to be very successful in its day, 1913, Max Meldrum's portrait of his mother. And again, this work went immediately into its state gallery, the National Gallery of Victoria, in the year 1913. And like the artists with whom we began, Max Meldrum had spent many formative years in Europe, in France in fact, absorbing the old masters. And you can see very much that this is an old master tribute picture. This wonderful picture, which is in the National Gallery, was also one of the great successes of the year 1913. It's Violet Teague's portrait, Boy with a Palette. It was actually painted the year earlier, in 1912, and shows the 12-year-old Theo Scharf, child prodigy artist. Unfortunately, we don't have time today to get into his subsequent career, but he made an extraordinarily stylish portrait subject. And this picture was included in the Society of Women Painters exhibition in Sydney, where it was recognised as the great picture in that exhibition. Next, please. And then we have another very highly regarded picture in 1913, Summer is Here, Manly Beach, by Ethel Carrick Fox. And that was included in her one-person exhibition. And was recognised as, really a very vibrant representation of Sydney beach culture in that year. Interestingly, in one of the newspaper reviews, it says this is Christmas Day. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily right or not, but it's an interesting element. And the beach was one of those subjects which Ethel Carrick Fox made her own. And we're going to talk a little bit about her a little bit later. Next, please. Hans Hyson, I mentioned Red Gold was one of the great pictures of the year. And This is a painting from 1912, which he was still working on in 1913 and continuing to in 1914, Approaching Storm with Bushfire Haze. And it's that kind of dramatic and serious subject painting, which was really one of the dimensions of the very popular painting of that year. Heysen's career was fabulous in 1913. He sold prodigiously. And he was able to really consolidate the career that had really begun around the 1890s, and he was really on song and painting these pictures, which are still some of the great loved pictures of the Australian landscape. Okay, so that's heroic. It's masculine, and there's another side. Next slide, please. And that's this wonderful picture. It's fantastic that we were able to put it in the 1913 exhibition. Sewing, also by Hans Heysen, and depicting his wife Sally at the Cedars with that wonderful sunlit window that she's working behind. A really marvellous picture. And I think now that foreshadows what I want to do, and that's just shift gear a little bit and look at not these grand, weighty subject pictures, landscapes of artists such as Streeton and Lambert and Datolo Rubo, and look at a more intimate dimension to the art of 1913. Next slide, please. Now, it's kind of weird to see this tiny watercolour, that size in reality, by J.J. Hilder, blown up to this colossal proportion. But Hilder is here in this lecture representing a part of art practice where artists were looking for the very quiet, tiny moment, making a subject out of a rusticated boat shed, or next slide, please, or just a paddock with a few trees in the distance, and you can see in these watercolours the love of texture and the way in which Hilda used this this very heavily textured paper to get these wonderful watercolour effects. Hilda was a very, very popular artist in 1913 and the subsequent years. He died of tuberculosis in 1916, and there was a book about his work published. And his work was really cherished for that restraint which made art out of such small subject matter. He had lots of imitators, but he was really a great exponent of that. Next, please. Now, while we're looking at the intimate, we're looking at watercolours, we're looking at drawings. The case of Thea Proctor is, I think, one of the most interesting dimensions of art in 1913. Shouldn't really call it the case of Thea Proctor. It sounds like a kind of Agatha Christie story, doesn't it? Thea Proctor had decided at a very early stage in her career, really in the 1890s, just when she was starting off, to give up oil painting altogether and become a graphic artist. She went to London. She described herself as a poster artist, which essentially meant a graphic artist, and specialised in drawing and in printmaking, and decided to really base her artistic practice on two things. One, really solid, clear drawing, and the other dimension was a real embrace of the decorative. Right throughout her life, and Thea Proctor died in the 1960s, she held on to this idea that art should be decorative. Now, decorative is a word that's come to have all sorts of negative connotations when it comes to art. Oh, it's decorative. But Thea Proctor embraced the best sense of what decorative actually meant. This is Siesta, painted in 1913, one of a series of drawings of a model really dressed up in 19th century fancy dress. And Thea Proctor came back to Australia after a number of years in London in 1912. She was here for 2 years. She had a number of exhibitions which were hugely successful. And in 1914, she went back to London, describing the Australian art world as just being entirely parochial and just not with it in terms of modernity. When she was on her way back to London, the news came through that the First World War had broken out. Almost everybody going to London on the ship from Australia left the ship on the journey, and Thea Proctor continued on to London. Nothing, she said later, would have convinced her to come back to Australia at that time. She did eventually come back to Australia in 1921. Next slide, please. So this is Thea Proctor in 1912, photographed by May and Minna Moore. Wonderful picture. And you can see the way in which Thea Proctor was actually making of herself a decorative object. And her studio in the 1920s, when she came back to Australia, was the most elegant place you could possibly go and have tea. Lapsen Souchong, as it turned out. Next slide, please. And this is a work which is not dated, but was shown in Adelaide in 1914. So it was a work that Thea Proctor had with her when she came back from London, and was shown just before she decided to return to London, her music hall singer. And here I think we've got a completely different note. If you think about what we started with, we've got a real sense here that art is about design and it's about colour. And, of course, Thea Proctor was one of the artists who embraced the Ballet Russe as an experience in London and then later in Australia. Next slide, please. So this is an interior, 1913, photographed in July 1913. It's the House Merriula in Woollahra, Sydney. And Merriula's got a big history in Australian art, which we won't go into today because we don't have time. But in 1913 was the newly refurbished home of the Allen family, Arthur Wigram Allen, and photographed by him in 1913. And I include this simply to indicate the type of interior that was the interior into which Thea Proctor's work would have been included. You can imagine those fan paintings, those watercolours, being a part of an environment such as this. And, of course, in the 1920s, that pared-down limewood, white-painted and lacquer interior aesthetic that Thea Proctor promoted was very different from this. But even so, in 1913, this was what we might call a decorative ensemble to live with. And this is what artists were working, at least in part, to include, to have their work included in. Next slide, please. So the arts and crafts were almost indivisible from the fine arts in this period. And so you had really significant artists working outside of these large kind of salon exercises such as the Royal Art Society. The arts and crafts societies, and there were arts and crafts societies in every capital city of Australia, were enormously popular, and their exhibitions were full of the most fantastic work, such as this piece of copper work by Elizabeth Soderbergh. Elizabeth Soderbergh, who was a stalwart, really, of arts and crafts exhibitions in Australia from 1907 until 1922. She was from Denmark originally, studied in Australia, and she went back to Denmark and died there in 1939. This is a wonderful use of Australian motifs in the decorative arts. Next slide, please. As is this, a bowl in the Art Gallery of New South Wales. And next slide, please. Not quite sure there's too much in terms of an Australian motif in that work. It's a dolphin sort of candelabrum. But it's in the Art Gallery of New South Wales, which has a very good collection of Elizabeth Soderbergh's work. And she, in the 1913 exhibition, is there with Gertrude Rushton and her carved settle with the beautiful kookaburra design to represent what was a very big movement in Australia, and that was to use Australian flora and fauna in the decorative arts. Next slide, please. The other dimension of art in 1913, which was, I guess, an antidote to these big set-piece pictures, was what was called black and white art. So here, represented by Norman Lindsay, this is one of the great scandals of 1913. This drawing, Crucified Venus, had been made in 1912 and shown in Sydney without too much fuss. I think everybody was kind of used to Norman Lindsay in Sydney. He was out to shock. But when it went to Melbourne, it was a different story. It was shown in an exhibition in Melbourne representing the artists of New South Wales, and it was removed from display as a result of protest from that part of society which Norman Lindsay enjoyed baiting wowsers. He was very vigorously anti-clerical, as we know. The picture remained off display for a week. Julian Ashton, who was the leader of the New South Wales delegation, decided that he was going to protest. And after protests, the work was reinstalled on display. Interestingly, in a rather kind of distorted form, that episode is included in that movie called Sirens. Remember that? Maybe you don't. Maybe best forgotten. next slide, please. So, yes, so this is Norman Lindsay in 1904, Pellice Verso, another Nietzschean kind of exercise where the world of the Greeks and the Romans are giving the thumbs down to Christianity. This picture was a pen and ink drawing, and it caused a scandal of a different nature when it was bought by the National Gallery of Victoria in 1907. And what was the scandalous thing? That the National Gallery of Victoria paid a huge price for a drawing. And that just shows you, I think, the way in which drawing, this kind of pen and ink drawing, which of course comes out of a long tradition of the illustrated newspaper, Punch, the Bulletin and so on, was really considered to be one of the really important dimensions of art practice. Next slide, please. And of course, etching. Now, this is Jessie Trail, and I don't need to tell you anything about Jessie Trail because there is the best exhibition which Roger Butler has put together at the National Gallery at the moment. Beautifully, beautifully put together exhibition showing what a fantastic artist Jessie Trail was. And this is a print from 1910, and although you can see in the shadows, there is in fact a little horse cart. it's a sort of different view of the bush from if we think back to Heysen's, you know, a storm with bushfire haze or red gold. It's a quieter a view of the bush. Beautiful prints. And I would love to have included a wonderful Jesse Trail etching called The Little Wood in the exhibition, but unfortunately it's over at the National Gallery. Have to go and see it there. Next, please. And this is in the exhibition, and it's, again, a little corner of the world represented in a tiny print by Victor Cobb. It's a mezzo tint from 1912 called a Melbourne coffee stall. Was shown in his exhibition in 1913. So printmaking, very important in those years. Next, please. And photography. Isn't this wonderful? I just put it in because I love it so much, because I'm not actually going to talk about photography. Helen Ennis is going to talk about photography in this lecture series. I'm not quite sure when. Do we have a date, Heidi? June, in 25th of June. So come and hear Helen Ennis talking about Rudolf Buchner and other artists at work in photography in that year. Next, please. Okay, from the intimate to the official art world of 1913. If you can stand this little excursion into officialdom. This is Lister Lister's prize-winning picture of the Canberra site, painted in 1913 and won him £250, the first prize. It was big prize money. In the competition to paint the site of the federal capital. Next slide, please. It won, but it's not a patch on this picture, which is Penley Boyd's second prize-winning picture. There wasn't to be a second prize in the competition, but the judges loved this picture so much that they decided to give him £150 for this picture, and of course they both now hang hang in Parliament, at Parliament House. It was interesting. The competition said that you had to paint the federal capital site in the middle of the day. Couldn't do it at the beginning of the day, couldn't do it at the end of the day. It had to have the effect of midday sunlight. Interesting. So those beautiful evenings that we're getting at the moment. Sorry, out. Okay, next, thanks. There was a lot of hope. And one of the themes, as Guy mentioned in the 1913 exhibition, is optimism. There was a lot of hope amongst Australian artists that the newly built Australia House in London would be the source of great public commissions. Arthur Streeton mounted a campaign in 1911 to have Australian artists commissioned to paint frescoes and to create sculptural pieces. And unfortunately, as soon as Australia House got started in 1913, 1914 came along, and cost-cutting in order to fund the war effort meant that Australia House's art commissioning program essentially fell into abeyance. The big mural pieces were never completed. But one work was completed, Phoebus driving the chariots of the sun, a sculpted piece which is a vast bronze pediment sitting atop the building, sits it atop still, and it was sculpted by Bertram McKennell, Australia's most successful expatriate artist, the first Australian artist to be knighted, and was a very successful Australian artist living in Britain. He went there in 1882 and lived there until his death. And this is one of his great pieces. And it actually managed finally to be installed in 1923. So no big public commissions happen quickly when it comes to sculpture. This was conceptualised in 1912 and really took a decade to actually finally be completed and be installed. Next slide, please. And I just chucked that in because I think this is the most charming picture I've ever seen of an Australian artist. That is Bertram McKennell with his wife. You know, it gives a different view of the man, I think, from from Phoebus driving the chariots of the sun. Anyhow, that's just a bit of fun. Bertram McKennell, great artist. Next, please. And this is in the exhibition. This is, and it really represents a very large number of commissioned works, portraits that were commissioned by the Historic Memorials Committee, which was established at the end of 1911 and was going strong by 1913. And George Lambert's portrait of the previous Australian Prime Minister, Sir George Reid, who was by then the Australia's High Commissioner in Britain, painted in 1913 and 1914, rejected on the basis, that it was a bit parodic and a bit too modern. That pale background was a sign of modernity in 1913. And John Longstaff, a painter who used a lot of bitumen in his paint and was famous for pictures with very dark backgrounds, eventually got the gig and painted a much less interesting picture of George Reid, which was duly accepted by the Historic Memorials Committee. But this is a wonderful picture. And again, it shows the way in which Australian artists in London, and Lambert was still in London in 1913, of course, really hung out for these big commissioned works. And it's interesting that Septimus Power, whose horse pictures we began with, when he came back to Australia, said, well, in Chelsea, we know all about what's happening in Australia. And we're hearing that exhibitions are doing really, really well in Melbourne and Sydney. And we're also hearing that there are these great plans for commissioned works. So these commissioned works kept a lot of artists going for quite a number of years. Next, please. I don't have the official commission that Emmanuel Phillips Fox undertook. And again, it's a much more official picture than this rather charming work of his from 1907, Bathing Hour, now in the Queensland Art Gallery. But I put it in because, in one sense, Phillips Fox and his wife, Ethel Carrick Fox, next slide, please, represent, I think, the great moment of 1913 for the returning expatriate artist. Phillips Fox had been in Europe on and off since the 1890s. He was originally from Melbourne and trained in Melbourne, and spent much of the years from 1905 until his return to Australia in 1913 in France. And I think you can see in his work and also in the work of his English-born wife, Ethel Carrick, some of the influence of Impressionist painting. Next slide, please. And you can also see it in the work of Hilda Rix Nicholas, who isn't actually included in the 1913 exhibition, but could have been. This is a work of hers from 1912, a Moroccan. It's called an Arab marketplace, and it's painted in as a result of her time in Morocco. What we're beginning to see here, I think, is a lightness and a colour starting to be a part of Australian art. Next slide, please. Here's a picture of all the crowds pouring along the road to South Head to see the fleet arrive in Sydney Harbour. The great event of 1913, the arrival of the Australian fleet. That's a photograph. And next slide, please. And this is a painting of the subject, of crowds looking at the fleet in the distance, by Ethel Carrick Fox. So she had a very successful series of exhibitions in 1913 and 1914. Her life was changed considerably when Emmanuel Phillips Fox died in 1915. Next slide, please. So we're beginning to see Impressionism, Post-Impressionism, colour start to make its appearance. And this is the Sydney Mail in September 1913, an article called "The Revolutionary Spirit in Art." Now, we tend to think, that there's this idea that Australian artists didn't really know what was happening in avant-garde circles in Europe. Well, here we have futurist pictures by Severini, cubist picture by Picabia, Francis Picabia, and a wonderful portrait by Matisse in the middle there. And it wasn't the only article about cubism and futurism in the Australian press at the time. What's interesting is that journalists in Australia didn't quite know what to make of these new forms of art. Australia hadn't yet developed the very virulent anti-modern stance that characterised official art circles in the 1920s and 1930s. In 1913, there was something of an openness to look at modernity, at new things. Next slide, please. And famously, Nora Simpson, a pupil of Anthony Datolo Rubo, went to London in these years immediately before the First World War, painted this picture, which is considered one of the kind of seminal works, I guess, in Australian modern painting, Chelsea portrait in 1915. And she came back to Australia and was a great a proselytiser, really, for a different approach to art, one based on colour. And you can see how light-filled and colourful this picture is, even in this rather poor reproduction. Next, please. So, she was a pupil of Datolo Rubo. This is his picture from 1913. And you can see the effect, next slide, please, on Datolo Rubo himself, a few years later. This is Pea Pickers, Currajong, a picture he painted in 1918. And you can see what an extraordinary difference. A receptive artist, as indeed he was, and of course he was the teacher of Grace Cossington Smith, great Australian modernist painter, and Roland Wakelin, and Roy de Maist. Here he's discovered broken colour, the daylight effect, sunshine. So that's really in 1913 beginning. That's all beginning to happen. Next. Now, I did promise that we were going to look at some underrated artists. if I have anything to do with it, Florence Rodway won't be underrated for much longer. Florence Rodway is a fantastic artist, and there's a beautiful pastel of hers in the exhibition. We couldn't get this for the exhibition, but it's pretty wonderful pastel from 1912. Next, please. This is a work that's in the National Gallery collection of hers, probably from about 1913. Next slide, please. Unfortunately, I would have loved to have included this in the exhibition, but it's too fragile. It resides in the State Library of New South Wales and is clearly a portrait of Henry Lawson by Florence Rodway, and it was drawn in 1913. So it would have been a wonderful thing to have in the exhibition, particularly as we begin the exhibition with a quote from that fantastic poem of Henry Lawson's when about being young, and which really gives the exhibition its title. So Florence Rodway, fantastic artist, and using the kind of broken... it would have been brushwork in an oil painting, but in a pastel, she used this wonderful effect to mix colour. And of course, with pastel, you know, the less you smudge the colour, the better. And so it's almost like the perfect pure pigment technique for colour, for a colourist. But unfortunately, this really represents what has happened to Florence Rodway. We couldn't get this to include in the exhibition. It won't be seen outside the State Library of New South Wales because it's too fragile. And it really is fragile. Can't travel. Can't be exposed to light for long periods of time. And so as a pastelist, unfortunately, Florence Rodway, a great artist, has sort of disappeared from view. So a medium choice has unfortunately, I think, obscured a great Australian artist. Rodway Street in Yarralumla is named after her father, who was the state botanist of Tasmania. Next. This is a portrait of, well, it's in the exhibition. Why is it weirdly like that on the slide? Next slide, please. Because it's a cut down. It's a cut down picture in the exhibition of something which was originally absolutely splendid. A low-toned harmony, a picture by Norman Carter, painted in 1911, and was, you can see in this illustration from a magazine of the time, awarded the bronze medal at the Paris Salon in 1913. I wish this picture still existed in its full form. It's absolutely magnificent. A low-toned harmony, a symphony of greys and browns with touches of red. Something must have happened to the picture over the course of its life. When the Mitchell Library was given the picture by Norman Carter in the 1960s, it had already been cut down. A great shame, but a wonderful picture, and it shows Florence Rodway not only as an artist, but as a model. Okay, next slide, please. Now, a shift, because we've been looking at the art world such as it existed in the metropolitan centres of Australia and Europe. And here we are introducing something very different. This is a 1901 photograph of Baldwin Spencer, who is sitting. He's sitting on the right-hand side. And Frank Gillen, who is the postmaster at Alice Springs, sitting sitting to his left. And behind are, from left to right, Jim Kite, Early Kalika, one of the expeditionaries by the name of Chance in the middle, and one of the other Aboriginal guides on this expedition, starting from Alice Springs, Porula. Next, please. Now, Jim Kite, who is in the left-hand side of that picture, was himself an artist. And this is a page from an illustrated newspaper of 1913, and you can see that it's entitled Aboriginal Art, Carvings on Kaolin. And Jim Kite worked making these all sorts of wonderfully decorated objects and artworks on plaster in Charlotte Waters. And in 1913, he was recognised not only in this, but in a number of newspaper articles for his unique qualities as an artist. Next slide, please. And this is one of his fabulous sculptures that's in the National Museum collection. Isn't it fantastic? There's two grasshoppers on, and another. Next slide, please. And this is a decorated spear thrower by Early Kalika. So it's interesting that as soon as you go outside of this circle of metropolitan Australia, all sorts of other fascinating things are happening in art. And we're going to end with one of those moments. We're going to end. This is a portrait of Baldwin Spencer, rather differently composed from the photograph that we saw earlier, Baldwin Spencer painted. Well, the picture was started in 1917 and finished in Australia in the early 1920s. It's by George Lambert, and George Lambert has attempted to capture, I think, the gravitas of the great Australian pioneer of anthropology, and given him a suggestion of a desert background, Central Australian background. Next slide, please. Baldwin Spencer was responsible for making this fantastic collection of 50 bark paintings when he was in Arnhem Land in 1911 and 1912. And he continued to commission artists to create bark paintings through his collaborator, Paddy Carl, buffalo farmer at Owen Pelly. And one of the great things I think about, one of the most exciting things about putting the 1913, the Glorious Days exhibition for me, was the fact that we were able to borrow nine of these wonderful, wonderful bark paintings from that sensational collection at the Museum of Victoria. We'll just run through a couple more, but you can see them in the flesh in the exhibition. And lastly, thank you. And you can see, I think, what an extraordinarily striking expression this was for Baldwin Spencer when he saw bark paintings such as this when he was in Arnhem Land. And in a sense, I think, he was looking forward the future in terms of what we now regard and what in 1913 would have been probably impossible for most people to regard as being great art of Australia by our Indigenous artists. Okay, that's 1913. End of story. Questions? And thank you very much for the technical assistance. Appreciate it.
So thanks very much, Andrew, for that wonderful glimpse into the world of art and artists in 1913. So we now have about 10 minutes for questions. So any questions for Andrew?
About anything.
Look, I can warm you up, perhaps, well, give people a chance to think. I wonder, as you talk about those artists, so many of them went to England to make a mark in their careers, and it just sort of makes me think, were there artists who chose not to go to England, or was it really such a dominant thing that to make your professional career as an artist, you had to go to the metropolis, you had to go to London? Was that really the only path, or were there artists who forged other ways?
Oh, there were lots of paths. There's no doubt that in 1913... most serious Australian artists in terms of international careers, and it really is, you know, I mean, it really is the beginning of Australia's engagement with an international art world, this period, would have seen success in London as the apogee. Certain artists saw success in France as the apogee, Rupert Bunny, for example, and they were always hoping to get the big commissions. In France, that was big public decorative commissions, and Australian artists really had very little chance of getting those sort of state-sponsored gigs, and also portraiture, of course. But, you know, if you look at a magazine, the British Australasian, which was a magazine specifically devoted to what it was like to be an Australian in Britain, you realise just what an extraordinarily rich world, the world of Australians in Britain was. So it was hardly surprising that artists saw that as being success. But there were many, many paths, and I mentioned in passing Theo Scharf, who was painted by Violet Teague in that wonderful Boy with a Palette, remember that picture? Child prodigy. He, in 1914, he had a very successful exhibition at the age of 14, went to Munich to study. Well, Munich when you went to Munich in 1914, that was, you know, his career it just went complete in a completely different direction. He became a printmaker in the 1920s, an official war artist in Germany in the Second World War, and really, you know, his career went in a completely different direction. So today he's remembered only for those prints, really, in the 1920s, and as the subject of that wonderful picture. Louise.
Perhaps staying within that broad framework of the relationship between Australian art and the international art world, I understand there's been a lot of analysis of the impact of American painting on Australian painting, particularly in the frontier kind of context, and I think you might have even addressed that in the work you've done on landscapes previously. Anyway, my question is, at this moment, was there much interaction between the American art world and the Australian?
Not a great deal.
No.
In fact, it's interesting, you know, in art history, the Armoury Show of 1913 has this extraordinary kind of a status because, you know, you had Marcel Duchamp and you had Brancusi and you had all these great names of modernism there in 1913. I don't think it had any impact at all in Australia. None that I can discern. So, if there is any sense of a connection, it's more a parallelism. And in fact, the exhibition that you allude to, New Worlds from Old, that that I was partly responsible for in 1996, was actually to look at two parallel streams of engagement with the landscape. But in fact, there wasn't a great deal of interchange between them, apart from the fact that George Washington Lambert's middle name was Washington. He was named after. He was named after George Washington. Any other questions?
Well, you did
yes.
Say,
you did
so
yes. Yeah, this is going to get exciting. I can tell.
I wondered if you could tell us what you're planning on doing in Melbourne.
Pursuing my first love. Art history.
I thought you were
going to
say your wife.
There has been something written about that too. Yes. No, I'm.
Do you have anything particular in mind?
No, it's a case of watch this space. I do have things in mind, but you know, who knows where they'll go. So once. But in answer to your question, no, I don't have another official job to go to. But I've got lots of projects. So, and most of them are to do with this kind of stuff. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Oh, I think it's time to go and have some sandwich, isn't it?
Okay. Well,
okay, thanks.
Let us thank Andrew again. Now, the wonderful thing about this talk is you can actually go and see many of those artworks in the exhibition, which is on right now. So please take the opportunity to see what those artworks look like beautifully hung in our gallery upstairs. So obviously we want you to get along and see the exhibition. Also, you can take something home with you, which is the book about 1913, which includes Andrew's essay on Australian art in 1913. It's got quite a good one on sport as well in there as well. So thanks very much. And I'll just remind you, the next lecture in the series is by Tom Griffiths, and it's on Australia and Antarctica in 1913. So the fun continues. Thank you very much for coming.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.